Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the show. Ewan, I get the feeling that you might be a little ticked off about something.
Very good. You've obviously been practicing that one. Yes, this is the blue tick controversy on Twitter, which has been playing out on Twitter mostly.
As with all controversies on Twitter, mostly very important on
very
Twitter.
Important.
Not very important to basically everyone else.
Yes, exactly. The news that some Twitter accounts with more than a million followers have had their blue tick badges reinstalled without them needing to pay the $8 a month to subscribe. But more interesting than that is some research into which politicians have been choosing to cough up the money to keep their verified blue ticks.
Yeah, Andrew McDonald from Politico was looking into this, and he says they include the former business secretary, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Nadine Dorries, and also Andrew Bridgen, famous most recently for his tweets about COVID vaccines. So at least we know he's a prolific user of the site.
Yeah, interesting. They've all decided to pay the money for the little blue tick. Hugo Rifkin of The Times says, in a tweet obviously, that the whole affair has been a resentful result against an elite. Some people really resented not being part of the Twitter elite, he says. They wanted the system to be smashed. But now the system has been smashed with the help of billionaire Mr. E. Musk. Well, nothing is really better. Now we can see who exactly was bothered about not being in the elite, because they've had to pay for a little blue tick to tell us.
Really,
I'm never going to say that, little blue tick
yeah,
ever
exactly.
again.
I mean that nearly went very wrong, and perhaps would give us a much greater indication of how some of us might feel about the changes on Twitter as well.
We should never speak about Twitter again.
Yes, I think we're probably going to conclude on that point there. But look, I mean, it's sort of, this is one of these things that's very important to some people and only matters to a very tiny percentage of the population.
Mostly journalists.
Yes, indeed. And thus that is all the attention we shall give it for now.
So the Prime Minister is holding talks today with major businesses and investors as his government tries to fill a void created by the implosion of Britain's biggest business lobby group, the CBI. But let's discuss this with our UK business editor, Julian Harris. Julian, what do you think the government is trying to get out of all of this today?
I think it's very convenient timing for the government, really. I suspect Rishi Sunak, Jeremy Hunt have been planning this for a while, largely because the Conservative government's relations with business have not been great for a long time and have been dealt with in very different ways by previous administrations. Obviously, we had the Boris Johnson expletive, which was perhaps the low point, but also they see... they see the business world and the economy through a very different eyes than Johnson and or you could say probably Truss and even May. So I think that this today so far it seems to be a very Sunak-esque event. It's all very slick. It is well attended, fair enough. There's some really big name CEOs there. It's all very positive. It's sort of back to free market futuristic sectors, this kind of stuff. But of course, it comes while the CBI is seemingly imploded, and I don't think they'll be particularly fussed about that. I think quite the opposite. I think this, as you say, this kind of very neatly makes it look as if this administration can conduct these relations on its own terms without the need for that sort of group.
So does that appear to be the bigger plan then, rather than having a replacement group that emerges that would speak for business in the way that the CBI has done up until now? Of course, the CBI suspending large parts of its operations last week due to the investigations it's holding following allegations of sexual misconduct against staff members. So is the government trying to rather, as you say, bypass the idea of having a business lobby like that altogether? Or is there a question that perhaps another organisation could spring up in its place?
I think they wouldn't want to be seen to be doing that, but I think that is quietly what Conservatives would quite like. They haven't been enamoured with the CBI for a long time. Obviously, there was the fallout over Brexit and everything. But I think generally, as we keep seeing in Westminster, the Conservatives and civil servants see things in very different ways. And from the Conservatives we've spoken to, and even people in the lobby group area, there are no tears being shed, really. And I think they're probably aware that it would be negative for them to be seen to be pushing the CBI under. But while they can just stand there serenely and kind of let things pass, then they will do that. I think it's important to say this group, I mean, this what they've started today is very much led by the government. So it's very, very different from the CBI, which is, you know, a sort of separate party neutral body set up by King's Charter. But it does what they will be certainly hoping for is that it presents the impression that they're not so reliant on one big lobby group like the CBI. There are, of course, still lots of other lobby groups as well, and this is the thing that needs to play out. There are a lot of people in the business world, in the finance world, who will probably say, we've got our own groups, we have our own sector-specific groups, we have our own relations with the government, and maybe some of those people are not desperate to have a new CBI set up.
So there could be a sort of splintering of business representation. Are business still okay being seen to be close to the Conservatives? Or do you think, as we approach a general election in which the Tories might be turfed out, do you think some businesses are getting a bit more cautious about that?
I think so, yeah. I think they're aware of, even though things fluctuate and they have done in recent weeks, ultimately the chances are that Keir Starmer will win the next election and then we'll have a Labour government potentially for some time as well. And that's why we have seen businesses sort of shifting slightly towards Labour. Some people have stuck their necks out, which we've reported. We've had one or two defections even sort of directly from Conservatives to Labour. Most, of course, will be far, far more cautious than that. So it does, while there still is 18 months at least, one would think of this government to run, and it is getting along with everyday business, it makes sense to be at these events, and I don't think it looks too bad for them. But they absolutely have an eye on maintaining strong relations with Labour.
So for politicians, is this then an opportunity for them to speak more directly to businesses if the CBI is in limbo as it is now? Or why is it so important that they, I suppose, try to move on from this and find a new way of talking to business?
I think for this government in particular, for these politicians, they're just very keen to reset how the Conservatives are seen. And it wasn't that long ago that we had, financial calamity essentially on the markets and the pound plummeting, and prior to that, the idea that the Conservatives were the natural party of business and pro free enterprise and so on was absolutely eroded as it went in a different direction, and certainly for Sunak and Hunt, this is the example to reinstate that, and the Prime Minister has been very heavy on that rhetoric this morning and talking about how he will be he is unashamedly pro-business and enterprise, whether you're talking about big companies or small companies. He's not trying to kind of couch it as politicians still do. So I think a lot of it is that kind of branding. I do wonder whether some of the businesses in the room will think, like, how much of this stuff will they have time to implement, given that there will be an election in not too long.
Julian, really interesting to get your view. Thanks so much for joining us. That's our UK business editor, Julian Harris, on the rapid unravelling of the CBI.
Now, Labour MP and former frontbencher Diane Abbott has been suspended from the party after she wrote a letter saying that Jewish people do not face the same sort of racism as black people. She's later apologised for the comments, which are published in the Observer newspaper. But it comes as the Labour Party is trying to move on from years of accusations of anti-Semitism under the former leader, Jeremy Corbyn. Well, to discuss now the broader issues around this, we're joined by the barrister and author, Hashim Mohammed, whose book, People Like Us, What It Takes to Make It in Modern Britain, tackles some of these issues. You've also written Britain about racial justice and social justice in the UK as well. So it's interesting to have you with us today, Hashi, on the programme. I wonder what your view is on this controversy around what Diane Abbott had to say.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I think it's a really unfortunate set of circumstances. I think there are about probably four things that come to mind, really. One is that we can't ignore the context in which these comments have come. And that context is a Labour Party that was led by Jeremy Corbyn, to whom she was quite close, that was accused of and found to be not taking this issue of anti-Semitism quite seriously. So we can't ignore that background. We can't ignore the way in which Keir Starmer is approaching this and trying to be seen to be acting on this matter. The second is also the history of what this issue is about in this country, whether it's about anti-Semitism, whether it's about racism. The history that we have in this country is that we really haven't been able to grapple with this issue in a way that we can have an adult conversation and have a meaningful conversation without people sort of either saying that you mean this or you mean that, and unable to give each other the benefit of the doubt and have that debate in good faith. Third was just about this question of the ability to not appreciate that if you are going to talk about racism against Black people, you shouldn't sort of invalidate the racism and the prejudice that other communities might face. And it's what I call the sort of grievance Olympics, whereby if you were to try and talk about the racism that's affecting one particular group of people, it doesn't mean that the racism that faces the travellers, the prejudice that faces the Jewish people and the Jewish community is somehow less important or less valid or less prevalent. And again, it's that ability to not have that final conversation to have that. And then the final thing is just generally at the moment, people are much quicker to take offence, much quicker to want to say you're wrong, much quicker to disagree, and much, much more likely to get clicks and sort of engagement on that basis rather than trying to find common ground and giving people the benefit of the doubt. So that's what I think is the context of this, really.
Did Labour then, in your view, make the right decision by suspending her? I mean, Diane Abbott is a role model for many people. She's the longest serving Black MP in Parliament. She's someone who has been blazed a trail in her own way throughout her career.
Yeah, I think the Labour Party has made a decision that is politically savvy, but I don't necessarily consider it to be a useful decision for how we advance the ability to have a conversation about this issue. Diane Abbott was the first Black woman to be elected to Parliament, one of four Black people to be elected to Parliament in 1987. She has an enormous amount of respect and cachet within the communities that she has helped out in Hackney, within the Labour Party, within the Black community. And so it might have been a bit more wise for the Labour Party to have been careful about how they would have reacted to this. But again, a Labour Party that's trying to distance itself from Jeremy Corbyn, a Labour Party that's trying to get elected, a Labour Party that is attempting to look that it's acting and not dithering, this sort of thing makes sense. So it's politically savvy, but I don't think it helps us in being able to have a much better conversation, a much wiser way of discussing this very thorny and very difficult issue.
Looking at the wider context, I know this is something you've written about before, the Sewell Commission report on racism, or the lack of racism in this country, something which plenty on the left have criticised. The report did reflect the views of some Black and minority ethnic people in Britain, didn't it? That Britain is a place of opportunity. Are you sort of totally against the broad thrust of the Sewell report?
I was against. Again, as a lawyer, you might be you might appreciate that I'm very careful with my own words. Would I say I was against the total thrust of it? I think I was. Yes, I think I would say I was against the total thrust of it. But was I against the whole report and everything that it had in it? Absolutely not. The general point that it was trying to convey, in that we've made progress in this country, that we are much better at helping people of minority backgrounds than most of our European neighbours and certainly the Americans. Are we just generally a better society than we were when Stephen Lawrence died and we had the McPherson report? Absolutely. But are there continuing issues? Yes. Have some things gone back? Absolutely. Are we still seeing Black people being disproportionately stopped and searched or killed? Are we seeing Black women disproportionately dying during childbirth? Are we seeing a disproportionate amount of prejudice when it comes to your name on a CV? Try being a Black guy with a Muslim name called Hashim Mohammed and applying to a very elitist profession like the bar. I mean, so the notion that we have made progress is absolutely correct. But what I thought the Sewell report did was that it was basically a political positioning of a conservative government that was very keen on just papering over the major fault lines that exists and then overstating the progress that we've made. And that's my issue with the Sewell report.
Well, how do then we get to, as you put it, a position where we can have an adult conversation about race in Britain in 2023? How should we frame that conversation? And how do we, I suppose, take it out of the context of reports like the Sewell report, which you've criticised, and what we see on social media and that sort of knee-jerk reaction that you talked about a little earlier that we see in many different spheres?
Yeah, I think that's quite easy to do. The first thing you've got to acknowledge is, as a society, we've made a huge amount of progress, but we still have much more to do. And so the idea that somehow we will get to a point where no racism exists, where there is no longer any prejudice, where that nobody will ever be discriminated based on an accident of birth is nonsense. And so we've got to stop thinking that we will ever get to a point where this issue is no longer an issue. The problem of racism and prejudice generally has been around for the dawn of time. It's the way humans react to each other. It's the way that we understand each other, frankly. It's the way we differentiate from one another. So the first thing to note is just we made a huge amount of progress and we've still got much more to do, but we're never going to get to a point where we think we've arrived. That's another big fundamental error that most people make when it comes to trying to understand this issue. The second is that, you know, the idea that minority groups cannot be racist or prejudicial, or that their policies, political ideas and actions are somehow immune or neutral because they might be Black or brown, is nonsensical. Take Suella Braverman, take Rishi Sunak, and think about their policies and the kind of things that they've been talking about, whether it's Rwanda or British Pakistani men and grooming gangs. The notion that somehow what they're saying could not be prejudicial or racist because they happen to be brown people who have children of immigrants is absolutely bogus. And so again, you know, the white folk of society do not have a monopoly on racism. And that's another aspect of the conversation that is often papered over and misunderstood. The next aspect of this is that we need to be careful with our words. Words matter. Words make a difference. Words hurt, bruise, and have long-lasting effects on society, particularly if they are mentioned and or uttered by people of huge influence in our society, a Home Secretary, a Prime Minister, a boss, a manager, and so on. And so for me, it's acknowledging the fact that we've made a huge amount of progress, but that we are never, ever going to eradicate racism completely. White people don't have a monopoly on what it means to be racist. Words matter, and what that looks like involves being very careful about what you say and how you say it. And then finally, just being candid about our own specific problems without being influenced by the French or the Americans, but British society specifically as we currently stand and as we are doing. It's an enormous amount of amazing progress to see a Prime Minister and a Home Secretary who are incredibly powerful people who happen to be minorities themselves. But are they making progress to this society when they talk the way that they do and they act the way that they act? Are they genuinely making progress? Because I think that's a massively lost opportunity. They could stand there and say, we've done a lot, but we've got much more to do. But these are the actions we're taking, and this is why we're taking them, without wanting to vilify a specific group of people.
Hashi, really interesting to get your thoughts. Hashi Mohammed, author of People Like Us, What It Takes to Make It in Modern Britain. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Several nations have ramped up efforts to evacuate their citizens from war-torn Sudan. Countries including the UK and the US have organised rescue efforts. The World Health Organization says that more than 420 people have died and at least 3,700 others have been injured amid intense fighting between Sudan's army and the Rapid Support Forces militia. Let's speak to Bloomberg's Simon Marks, who covers East Africa for us. Simon, can you please explain the background to this latest flare-up of violence and what exactly is happening in Sudan now?
Well, as of this morning, I've been speaking to the few residents who do have access to internet in the city, and there is still violence raging. And that is going on amid mass exodus from Khartoum, the capital. Many people are heading north towards Egypt. Others are taking a road east towards Port Sudan, where they're hoping to get boats out across the Red Sea. And all of this really began on April 15. That's when this current conflict broke out. But it comes after many, many months, even years of growing tensions between these two generals. Burhan came to power after the fall of Omar al-Bashir, the former dictator. And he was head of the Sudanese armed forces. Meanwhile, you have Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who is the head of a paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces, which gained power under the former dictator by helping the government quash dissent, mainly in Darfur, but also in central areas of Sudan. And over recent years, he's had a lot of backing from Gulf states and others in the region to really grow into a massive military power in the country.
Simon, what's the situation like on the ground? What's it like for ordinary Sudanese? I read in your piece that there's only 2% of connectivity to the internet across the country.
Yeah, quite amazingly, people have had access to data on their phones up until now. But beyond that, the situation is really devastating. The majority of hospitals, so 90% of hospitals, are just not functioning, and the remaining 10% are really hanging on for everything they've got. Supplies are running low. There's no water in many parts of the city, running water, so people are really scrambling to buy bottled water. Food is also running low. You know, Sudan is one of Africa's poorest countries anyway, and their health system's always been teetering on the edge. So this has really plunged it into a complete crisis.
We've seen a number of countries, including the UK and the US, to organise rescue efforts to get their citizens and their diplomats out of the country. How big an exodus is this, and how significant is it that we have Western governments like the UK making these decisions?
Well, the situation had become so dire in the city, and many diplomats and UN officials had been actually injured or assaulted in what was happening. So I think the international community took a decision at some point that they just had to get their key staff out. Now, so far, we've seen hundreds leave in planes, and in some cases, vehicles, as they go towards Port Sudan. Some key staff for certain embassies have remained. For example, the EU ambassador to Sudan is still in the country and has pledged to continue trying to do some work there. But it is significant, and many Sudanese people feel very angry that the international community is sort of hanging them out to dry after essentially backing these two generals in the negotiations for a so-called democratic transition in the country. So many people think they should have been condemned after a coup that took place in 2021, and that sanctions should have been rolled out. And instead, these two men were allowed to foster power and stay in a position of leverage.
Bloomberg's Simon Marks, who covers East Africa for us. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Well, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Well, this episode was produced by James Walcock, and our audio engineer was Marouful Hussain. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.